and welcome to Backchat from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM. That's 103.2 FM up in Preston. And Nikki Radio in Hertfordshire and our listeners in Swindon. You can also access the show on radioforall.net. I'm Kirsty Paul.
And I'm Kay Sanganathi.
And I'm Marie Langan. Coming up in the show...
First, even if you wasn't a Muslim, just the human nature is that for you to have self-respect and for if there was a father, he would want his daughter to be protected and not be exploited. That's something that's already there in our intrinsic human nature. What our religion teaches us is that losing virginity is something that is actually sacred. We're not against it. It is something that's sacred, but we should have that with someone that we trust and we know that someone that we're actually married to.
Our theme this week is the sex exploitation of young girls. Muslim women express how their religion helps them to resist peer pressure and respect women's rights.
The birds absolutely love nesting in the hedgerows. It's protection from predators. It's also protection from the wind and the elements and the rain, prying eyes and other cats as well, potentially, depending on what the hedge is. You've got quite a wide range of garden birds will nest in your hedge, like the sparrows and the blue tits and the great tits. But also people might like to look out and see the things like the robins in there.
Award-winning gardener Jodie Farish is back with more garden tips. But first, let's hear a track by Frank Zappa, Valley Girls. Valley Girls, she's a valley girl.
I like buy the neatest mini skirts and stuff. It's like so bitchin' because like everybody's like super, super nice. It's like so bitchin'. Like, anyway, he goes, are you into S&M? I go, oh, right. Could you like just picture me in a, like a leather teddy? Yeah, right. Hurt me. I'm sure, no way. He was like freaking me out. He called me a beastie. That's like his totally list. He goes like, bag your face, I'm sure. Cat box. I am sure that's like part of Encinas, okay? So, like, I don't know. I'm, like, freaking out, totally. Oh, my God. Hi, I have to get the orthodontist. I'm getting my braces off, Nick. But I have to wear a retainer. That's going to be really, like, a total bummer. I'm freaking out. I'm sure. Like, those things that, like, stick in your mouth are so gross. You gotta get saliva all over them. But, like, I don't know. It's gonna be cool, you know. I'll buy some, like, see my smile. It'll be, like, really cool. Except my, like, teeth are, like, too small. But no biggie. So awesome. It's, like, tubular, you know. Well, I'm not, like, really ugly or anything. It's just, like, I don't know. You know me. I'm, like, into the, like, the clean stuff, like Pac-Man and, like, I don't know. Like, my mother, like, makes me do the dishes. It's, like, so gross. Like, all the stuff, like, sticks to the plate. And it's like somebody else's food, you know? It's, like, grody. Grody to the max. I'm sure. It's, like, really nauseating. Like, bark out. Gag me with the spoon. Gross. I am sure. Totally.
That was Valley Girls by Frank Zappa.
So we have Lydia Donahue and Ella Trudgeon in the studio. Thank you very much for joining us, girls.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're going to be talking about the sexualisation of women, I understand.
Yeah, that's right.
How old are you both? Can I ask that? I know it's not polite to ask a lady her age, but Lydia, do you want to tell us how old you are?
I'm 16.
And Ella?
I'm 15.
Right. So do you find that society throws a number of images at you? Does it feel like a lot of pressure's being thrown in your direction when it comes to images and how you should portray yourself?
Yeah, definitely. From, like, it's all the pop culture. You see it in magazines, you see it on TV. The celebrities are also very sexualized. And there's definitely a pressure for us to go with rule or, like, to dress in a certain way. And it all starts from the top. So we have the fashion designers and whatever they design goes down to the shops, and then girls wearing it. You've got to think who creates this for girls to wear it, who the creators are of this type of image.
When it comes to fashion, is it quite a joyful thing, or is it actually quite a subject of much discussion at school? Is it something that people get judged on a lot?
I think for fashion people, that they kind of, like, they target the younger audiences, because I think the young girls, say, like, 11 or 12, are easily influenced and they're very, like, impressionable. They're targeted through magazines, like...
And in school, it's a important point, like, thing in life. How you dress
how you
is
dress
definitely...
How you look. Because even non-school uniform days, where people wear what they usually wear, it's kind of... I know there's a whole sort of...
Judging.
About it. It's like, oh, what are you going to wear? I'm going to wear this.
Yeah.
And do you think how much you spend has a bearing on that? I mean, is there a big discussion on how much you've spent on each item?
It's more about the look. Right now, I think in a lot of friendship groups, it's quite fashionable to buy from charity shops. And then generally, though, prices and brands are quite important. And if you've got a brand and you're buying that look, and that's what's very important for girls, I think.
So is it irrespective of how it looks? You wear something, it doesn't necessarily look amazing, but it's a great brand, it's very on trend. Would that be more acceptable than wearing something decent but not being a brand?
I find the year 7s and year 8s, which are 11, 12, 13, they all kind of wear the same thing. And I guess as we got older, we kind of realised that, you know, we can wear what we, like, stand out. Then I've noticed that they all wear the same things.
Yeah.
And school uniforms, how much customisation goes on?
Quite a lot. As you get older again, they let you off a bit, because we're just before sixth form, which is a non-school uniform school, so there's kind of rules, but people can wear, like, not coloured tights, but they can bend the rules. And there's always skirts. There's a big thing about how high your skirt can be.
People wear really tight skirts, pull them up. There used to be a few years back, there's these school shirts, cotton t-shirts. Someone was in the school with, like, you'd pay them a certain amount of money and this girl would, like, sew it in so that it was really tight fitting compared to the usual bagginess that we were supposed to be wearing.
And we had an assembly for all girls about how we dress inappropriately quite recently, actually. It was about male teachers' distraction and the younger years' distraction, because we have quite a lot of stairs in the school. It was during summer as well, and it got a position where people had to be told what to wear.
And are you both in agreement with what was said in assembly? You're dressing inappropriately. How did that make you both feel?
I did agree with what they were saying, but at the same time, I'm not, like, angry with anyone about it, and I'm quite relaxed with...
I think that people should be able to wear what they want to wear, of course, as long as it's not...
School's different.
That's inappropriate. But yeah, I guess school is different. Mm. But when you get to the age of what these people are 15, 16, I don't think that we should be wearing what they recommend is like all the way down, like just a centimetre above the knee or something.
We're talking about the sexualisation.
Mm. The way you dress shouldn't really define who you are. Because I think with the whole like short skirts things, I don't know, I don't think that just because you wear a short skirt, it doesn't make you
a certain person.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be put into, like,
A category
for that, yeah.
Do you think it's an important time at the moment to be experimenting with your look, with what you wear?
I think experimenting is quite important at this age. Trying different looks is definitely important so that you know when you're older what to wear.
Do you think that the music that you follow has an impact on how you dress, your fashion sense? And do you think that brings about any kind of pressure?
I know that from music videos especially, if I'm flicking through the channels and I see that a music video channel, I notice the way that they're dressing and the way that they're acting, and also the way that they present young girls, because there's the whole girl groups, which are like 17 years old, dressing a certain way, which I'm not saying is wrong, but I'm saying that young girls could be influenced by that.
And boy groups as well, with young girls 12 wanting to... Looking at boys at 18.
Yeah, the target audience being 11.
So it's kind of forcing people to be older than
growing up older, yeah.
And limiting their childhood. My sister's 12 and she reads magazines which are targeted for her age group. They'll feature things such as how to get a boy, tips on... Which I think is inappropriate because the people who are making the magazine realise that this is for a very young age, but yet they still carry on to promote and like encourage adult... Which things would be connected to adults.
Lydia Donoghue and Ella Trudgeon, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Bristol University celebrated Islam Week. We meet two students who explain what their religion means to them in everyday life.
I'm here at Islam Week at Bristol University, and I'm here with one of the students. Hello.
Hiya. I'm part of the University Islamic Society that has helped to organise this Islamic Awareness Week. So what we're trying to do is actually just, you know, raise awareness about our religion and our beliefs and how we go about our lives, just so that people can really dispel the myths that they might have had in the past in order to build bridges between different beliefs and different ideologies. We just think that it's a real shame that there has become this kind of divide between Muslims and non-Muslims. And we just want everyone to recognise that we really do appreciate everyone as a human being and we really connect on that level. And so we're just here to let you know that we as Muslims love you as human brothers and sisters, and that we just want to find out more about you and for you to find out more about us so that we can celebrate our differences and just be together and really tackle the issues of the world as a united organisation, really. Yeah.
In what way does Islam relate to modern society?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that you asked that question because, you know, what you'll find in the media is that Islam as an ideology is quite depicted as something that is contrary to so-called, you know, Western civilizations and contrary to Western ideologies. And I don't really think that to be the case. I personally believe that there are many foundational precepts that we believe in that the Western civilization are also built upon, for example, loving one another, being good to people, protecting yourself and protecting your honor, and just, you know, striving for excellence in all types of fields, whether it be academic, socially, and community wise and things like that. So I think that's very, very connected to the modern society. I believe as a Muslim, my purpose is personally to worship God and to get closer to him through doing things that he is pleased with, and one of the most things that he is pleased with is striving for excellence. And in order for the modern society to be developed and increased, we need to strive for excellence. So for me, that's how my religion is directly related to my own modern society, in that as Muslims we should be at the forefront of all spheres, academically, socially, sports-wise, whatever it is, we should be striving to better our society so that we can really, you know, take our places as humans on the earth who are, you know, we kind of really need to make sure that we strive for excellence in everything that we do. Yeah, so that's how I think that we, as Muslims, are connected to our modern society.
Do you think Islam sticks to family values?
Yeah, I genuinely think it definitely sticks to family values. I believe that it kind of, my own familial values have definitely originated from Islam. I don't really think it's something that is kind of borrowed from anywhere else. I just personally think, like, upholding ties of kinship, upholding family values amongst your own immediate family and other people is so important, to the extent that, you know, in our holy book, which is called the Quran, the way that that's what we follow in terms of our rulings and obligations into how we conduct our lives, God, he speaks about upholding ties of kinship in a way that is very important, and he plays it to such a high level in that it's obligatory for each and every one of us to uphold our family values. The mother is placed at a level that nobody else is placed at. To be bad to your mother in any way is such a bad, like a really big thing in Islam. And so that's really why we respect women in Islam, and we respect our fathers and our brothers and sisters. And that's not where it stops. It comes to the extent where your neighbours even become your family. Do you know what I mean? And it's very interesting how, unfortunately, in this day and age, we don't even know who's living next to us. But in Islam, you're really meant to value your neighbours, check up upon your neighbours, ensure that they're not going through any hardship. Because it is quite a big sin that if someone who's living next to you or in close proximity to you is going through an issue and you don't even know about it and you don't even help them about it, sometimes you can be culpable if you have the ability to alleviate whatever it was they were going through. So yeah, I think family values is central to our religion. And it's just really important for us to respect one another, because society is built up upon small units of families, and if the familial unit is aright, then society will be aright. And I think that one of the issues we're facing at the moment is the fact that families have been broken down, and so our society has therefore been broken down, because families are like the smaller units of societies, in my opinion. Yeah.
Some young girls have been turning to Islam, some British girls have been turned to Islam, and it's seen as a protection because of the pressure to sleep with boys from an early age. Mm. What's the Islam approach to that?
I think what I can say is something from my personal experience. Growing up in secondary school, going through year 7, year 8, I think I was 13, 14 at that time, there was a lot of social pressure that in order for you to fit in, you have to lose your virginity. And I think you obey what you think is the most important thing. And because to me, the most important thing was my honour and my religion and what my religious values was, for me to have that pressure of trying to fit in, I didn't really care about. For me, it was more important for me to uphold my actual values. So whereas for girls who, if the most important thing to them is to fit in, that is something that they can fall into. I think that from an Islamic perspective, first, even if you wasn't a Muslim, just the human nature is that for you to have self-respect, and for if there was a father, he would want his daughter to be protected and not be exploited. That's something that's already there in our intrinsic human nature. What our religion teaches us is that losing virginity is something that is actually sacred. We're not against it. It is something that's sacred, but we should have that with someone that we trust, and we know that someone that we're actually married to. So we don't just lose to any old person. And that's actually because of our value for it. It's because we value it that we do not want to just lose it under pressure or just anything just to fit in. But actually, it's so valuable that we would only want to do that within what God has allowed us to do it in, which is a union between a man and a woman. And that's the Islamic perspective. If girls, people obey what they think is most important, when they find a religion and they think is a truth, they would want to follow that, because they would want to worship their Lord, and they would want to do exactly what God would teach us to do. And one thing is, it's not that obviously we follow what God wants us to do, but we also realise that God wants what's best for us. He created us, and therefore he knows what is going to be good for us and what is not going to be good for us. He knows that losing your virginity to any old person and just keep losing it, it's something that's not good for us. It's not good for our souls. It's not good for us as a human being. And it can also, on a social level, It breaks family ties. You start to have families forming at ages that you weren't prepared for. You start having children that you didn't really prepare for. This kind of breaks down society in many ways. So it's actually a protection more than anything. And I think girls, maybe when they do turn to the religion, they see that, well, the eyes kind of open. They realise that this is not good for them. And I think what Islam does, it gives you strength. It gives you strength because you now obey a creator, you obey your Lord, you don't obey what society tells you to do. So that's why that's something that can protect you.
Do the men, Muslim men, do they respect that? They don't put pressure on the women because they respect that they want to save it till they're married or engaged?
That is what the religion teaches. I cannot, and that's what Muslim guys should do, but I cannot say that every Muslim guy respects that. I do know that Muslim girls and Muslim boys who don't actually respect that, and there are Muslim guys who may probably would put pressure, but that's maybe because they're not following the religion properly, and they might not even believe in the religion. It might be just something that they were brought up with. They don't follow it. It's just part of their culture. So some people just choose what to follow, choose what not to follow. But obviously, the definition of a Muslim is that you don't just believe in God, but you actually submit to God. That's what a Muslim is. You submit. So in essence, if you are practicing the religion, you should submit to God, and you would therefore not, you shouldn't be pressurising girls to do that. So, yeah.
That was Anthea Page at Islam Week, Bristol University.
And here we have Naomi Woodspring to talk about agriculture in Israel.
Well, sort of agriculture in Israel. I'm talking about the boycott of Israeli goods, particularly agricultural goods, which this boycott's been going on for quite a number of years. But I thought it'd be really helpful to give people some background and a general overview as to why the boycott's important and why they should consider not buying Israeli goods, and in particular Israeli agricultural goods. It's not a huge sector of the Israeli economy. About 2.6% of the Israeli economy is, or 2.6% of the GDP of the Israeli economy is made up of agricultural goods. And out of that, about 60% is fruit and veg, herbs and cut flowers. Out of that 2%, that's an expanding part of the economy. So why is it important to boycott Israeli agricultural goods? There's two really important reasons. The first one is the majority of agriculture happens in land that is what we call the occupied territories. So after the 1967 war, the Israelis took over a considerable amount of land that had been Palestinian and started what's called the settlements. And the settlements are people who have moved to Israel from the U.S., from Russia, from other places in the Middle East, Morocco, Iran, Iraq, and they've literally built modern villages on Palestinian land, claiming the land. And a lot of the vast majority of the agriculture happens in the occupied territories happens in this stolen land, which was, by the way, agricultural prior to the settlements, which is the second reason why it's really important to consider boycotting Israeli goods, because there's this mythology that the Israelis have constructed that Israel, the land of Israel, Palestine, was a barren desert, and the Israelis made the desert bloom. But in fact, it was a very fertile agricultural area long before the Israelis were there and when it was Palestinian Arab and Arab Jews who were agriculturalists. There were olive groves. It was forested. It was a beautifully exquisite land. This mythology that Israel made the desert bloom is just really a propaganda kind of lie. So that's the second reason that the boycott has a real deep psychic and psychological impact to underline this crazy mythology that Israel made the desert bloom. So if you go to any supermarket and you look at the labeling on flowers, on veg, on fruit, and herbs.
Definitely mentioned herbs.
You'll see on the labels, either if it's wrapped in cellophane, if it's packaged, or might be on that label or the label on the shelf, you'll see the country of origin. That country of origin, of course, should tell you where the produce comes from. Unfortunately, it's not the case with Israeli goods, because the boycott has indeed been very effective. And so fruit and vegetables, herbs and cut flowers, and particularly cut flowers, are now being sent to Holland, where they're repackaged and relabeled product of Holland, which is important to know. And like I said, that's particularly happens with the cut flower industry. Also, for Israel, for the agriculture in the occupied West Bank, the Jordan Valley, and all the occupied areas at this point, organics in general, organic fruit and vegetables, organic herbs, organic fruits, is a growing market. So about 75% of what Israel is now producing are organics. The UK is the second largest importer of Israeli agricultural goods in Europe, in the EU. The UK is important support to the Israeli market. So somebody has to do the heavy lifting, the crummy work of agriculture. And the people who do that, for the most part, there's a large segment of Palestinian workers who have work permits. And then there's about 10,000 workers who are illegal Palestinian workers, so they don't have work permits. But it's Palestinian workers who are, in fact, creating this agricultural miracle in Israel, and I say that in quotes, which sounds on the face of it like a good thing, except that Israel has very strict laws in terms of minimum wage, in terms of workers' benefits, and in Palestinian workers, even though they are entitled to those benefits and that minimum wage, they are not receiving it. And the courts are not enforcing the laws. A number of times, the workers' rights, minimum wage, has been taken through to the courts, and the courts say, yeah, sure, but they don't ever do anything to enforce it. So, in essence, Palestinians are very low paid, below minimum wage, with horrible working conditions. And there's no end in sight. There's no recourse for them. They've been through the courts. Nothing is going to change in the immediate.
And before Israel took the land in the West Bank, was this land being used for agriculture, and how were the workers being treated?
Yes, this land was being used for agriculture, and there were large farms, very large farms, but they were family farms, and there was a village system. The Bedouin, which, you know, we think of in Europe that Bedouins are nomadic. In fact, Bedouins were not nomadic, they were farmers. And it was primarily Bedouin land in the Jordan Valley. The Bedouins have almost been entirely erased from the Jordan Valley, and that land has been taken over for Israeli agriculture. And as far as workers, I would have to assume that given the structure of the culture prior to the Nakba, that people were treated fairly. Obviously, there's going to be always going to be creepy people mistreating people, but by and large, it was not the exploitive situation as it is today.
And the countries whose land was taken away, how have they suffered from the loss of agriculture?
Well, that's their culture. Agriculture was very important. And, I mean, people's olive trees, there's olive trees that are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years old that land has been cleared to create agribusiness, Israeli agribusiness, to create these high-rise apartments, these settlements for people coming in and taking the land over.
You were saying they're the villagers of the Bedouins. What's happened to them?
They're either put into camps. They wander into camps. They disperse in Jordan, Egypt. But a lot of Bedouins keep building small encampments to survive, to say, no, you cannot move us off our own land. And there are people whose temporary encampments have been destroyed 25, 26, 30 times, and yet their spirit is absolutely indomitable because of their sense of connection to the land in the Jordan Valley.
And you say that there are many Palestinians working on these agricultural farms who are not getting the money they deserve. But did they come from other countries in order to
No, these are this is their land.
This is their,
they are in servitude on their own land. It boggles the mind. The last thing, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk just a little bit about water. In order to grow things, you need water. You need lots and lots of water. Water is become a political issue in Israel, as it has in many places. But in Israel, 98% of the water is what's called public. And public means that it's owned by the Israeli government and controlled by the Israeli government. And included in that 98% are natural wells. So if you have, consider this, if you have your Palestinian and you have a natural well on your land, you do not have a right to that water. It is owned by the Israeli government. And many, many Palestinian farmers don't have access to water. They take their tractors miles and miles and miles to collect water and take it back to their farms, going through checkpoints, going down these crazy road systems that have been built for Palestinians, which of course are separate than the road systems for Israelis. So water is an enormous issue now in the occupied territories because Palestinians have no access, only limited access, and no control over their own water.
The only question I can ask is why?
I think at this point, one can only speculate. My personal feeling is that the Israelis have made a decision that they want a land with no Palestinians in it. They want utter and total control of Israel. And despite the way that the government was structured when statehood happened, in 48, the way the promises that were made in 1948, they've all been broken. And there doesn't appear to be any political will in Europe or in America to enforce what's all been promised before. And of course, as you know, I mean, the UN keeps cranking out these reports saying war crimes are happening. This is an outrageous situation. They don't use the word outrageous, but yeah. The UN cranks these reports out, and yet there's no political will to enforce or put in force any kind of measures that would stop the Israelis from... I don't want to use the word genocide because it's not a question so much of killing Palestinians, which, yes, they do. But that's only one tactic. Taking water, taking land, making life untenable in it's death by a thousand cuts.
My name is Dr. Awad Abu Freh.
You're from Palestine.
Yes, I'm from Palestine. I'm a Palestinian, from the Palestinian who live in Israel now.
And you've come over to Britain to tell people about the plight of the villages.
Yes, we feel all the time that the world hear about the Palestinian who live in Gaza or the Palestinian who live in West Bank or in Jerusalem. But our story, nobody know. We are living in our land, in our villages. We still stay in the land which occupied in 1948. Not 1967. We still there in our lands. We were there thousands of years. And we became Israeli because we have the passport. I'm a citizen of Israel, but I'm a Palestinian. We are a Bedouin living in the Negev. And now we're suffering all the time because the Israelians destroy our homes, our villages. We live in unrecognized village and we live without conditions, without water, without electricity, anything. But we live in our land. And we are a farmer. Now they take our land. We can't use our land. We can't live like Israeli citizen. We can't. We also, one thing we can do to leave. The Israelians want us to leave the Negev, the Nakab in Arabic, to leave the Nakab to maybe to Jordan or to Egypt. But we were there all the time over the history. This is our land. And we have the documents that we have a permit from British with the mandate from Turkey, the Ottoman period. The Ottoman time, we were there and they give us the recognition. And the British give us also the recognition. But the Israelian, they thought when they came, the Zionism project in Palestine, when they came to the Negev, they hope that they will be empty of people, empty of Arabs, empty of Palestinians. But maybe for them, it's a sudden shock because this is our land and we stay there. Now, before 1948... we were there more than 100,000 people who live in the Negev. The Negev is a very big area, and we live in all the area of the Negev. 1948, 90% of the Bedouin who live in the Negev exiled, killed, or pushed to move to Jordan. Only 10%, only 10,000 people stay in the land. The army of the Israelian relocated us all the Negev and push us in some very small zone. We called it Siyaj zone or restricted zone. And nobody can go out from this restricted zone.
You're like prisoners in your own land.
Yeah, we call us now the refugees in our land. We are refugees, but in our land. Now like a camps, but in our land. We saw our land, but we can't use it. Some of us now slide out from this block area, like me and like my family and like my village. And we built again our village, Kol El Arakib. When we built it in 1958, 1960, we built some of them, not all the village, because in 1948, there's 100 of people killed there. Only in our village, 13 people were killed by the kibbutz and the mushav, you know, the Israeli who live near our neighbors, the Israeli. But we built some of our village and we still there. It was very difficult. But all the time Israelian demolished the village, we built it again. They move us to that area and we slide and we run away from this blocked or jail, very big jail. That's like a jail, like Gaza. All the world now speak about Gaza. In the Negev, we like Gaza. There is no separated wall, but there is a law, army laws, army rules, in spite of the fact that we are citizens, but we are under colonial rules. Under now, we are struggle all the time for education, struggle for schools, for water, basic, very basic rights. Very basic right of water, right of housing, right of roads. We built roads, they destroy it. We built bridges and in the valleys we can't move from place to place, they destroy it. We build homes, they destroy it. The land, only the Jews can use the land as a farmer. Now we have only some water to drink, but all the Jews near us, they can use a lot of water in their land. But we have to buy the water from them. For example, we pay for 1 cube of water more than 50 shekels, and it costs in the kibbutz, in our neighbors, 2 shekels or 3 shekels. We pay 50 shekels for 1 cube of water. We have to transfer the water from place to place. There is no running water in our village. Nothing. And now there is a new, very dangerous plan. The government call it power report. By the law, by the Israeli law, we are invaders, that we invade the land of the state. And the Jews said we have to save. You know, I'm sorry to say that. I have nothing against the Jews in the world. I'm working with the Jews. But now there is the law. They said that we have to save the land from the others. Who's the others? We are the others. To save it, to take it back from the Bedouin, to relocate the Bedouin again in very small area. And they called it like this. There is a road number 40. It's crossed the Negev from the north to the south to divide the Negev two part. The eastern one, Bedouin can live. In the western side, no Bedouin, only for Jews, because the western side, there's good rain and there's green. And now they push us to the desert, to the dry, very dry space that we have nothing to do there, just to live and, you know, to suffer. And maybe they hope, maybe they will leave to another place. But I think it's very, very difficult now to explain to the world and also to the Israelian, we are ready to die there. We are ready. We live there all over the history. And now we're ready to die in our lands.
So we have our resident gardener, an award-winning gardener, Jodie Farish, in the studio with us. Hi, Jodie. What are you going to talk to us about this week?
Well, this week I've got a few things about what you can do in the garden at the moment. Later on I want to be talking about hedges, garden hedges and hedgerows in fields, but the benefits and the reason for having them instead of the usual fence panels. Well, plants to be putting out now in the garden, if you're interested in your fruit and veg, you could be looking at planting outside under cloches, things like the carrots and garlics, which have been the same for the last few months, and radishes and spinach. And if you're lucky enough to have a greenhouse, you might want to start planting in some seeds for, try something like asparagus or Brussels sprouts. Maybe some onions and leeks are good at the moment, and tomatoes are just starting. Other jobs for around the garden at the moment, you could be looking at pruning things, just getting them ready to look a little bit neater for the spring. Things like the dogwoods have just finished looking really nice with the red stems. The ornamental willows and wisteria is one to start looking at trimming back now. So all those long, whippy lengths can be cut back to one or two buds. You can dig over some beds and borders for where you're thinking of planting out some of your hardy annuals later on in the year. And also seed potatoes, putting out seed potatoes into daylight so that they create the little stems, the little shoots, which give it an early start rather than putting them straight into the soil.
So we're certainly not going to be idle. There's a lot that we can do in preparation. In fact, it is quite a good preparation time, but it's really cold out there.
It is very cold out there as well, yes, but things are warming up. I can feel it already when I'm outdoors. I can feel the difference in the temperature. It's a little bit milder. The cloche does warm the soil, so even if you're not putting anything into your garden, put out any cloches that you've got, and that will warm up the beds ready for planting things out maybe when we get to the end of February or March time. And other than that, get some good gardening gloves. that's what I do, and it makes a big difference every day.
So, okay. Jodie, tell us about hedges.
Okay. Well, hedges, they've been a bit of a decline over the last 20, 30 years in gardens. A lot of people now swap them for fence panels and chicken wire fencing, just because of what people perceive as a lot easier to put in, maintain, and just nice and simple to put into your garden. But a hedge, not only is it, to my opinion, easier to maintain, you don't have to preserve it every year. Yeah, the advantages of any way of putting in a hedge into your garden rather than the fence panel is creates obviously a natural habitat for things like birds and insects and small mammals. But you also get in the springtime and during the year, you get the nice blossoms on, depending on what you plant out there, but it can look a lot more attractive than a fence panel. It will grow a lot taller than a fence as well, which for some people, if you want to screen off something, can be quite useful. It doesn't need to be coated with fence preserving every year or every 10 years replacing even. Plant it once and be good for a lifetime almost if you keep it well maintained. And also with a fence, well, just like a fence, you've got the hedges can still support things like your rambling roses and clematis and honeysuckle, which will just climb over whatever you put up there. Again, just giving more colour and more, just an added something extra to a garden. People are put off by putting in hedges because they think that they're difficult to grow and they've already got their fence panels put in, which can be placed in a day. But if you think ahead, if your fences at the moment are coming to the end of their natural life and you think maybe another year or two left in them, you could just plant some nice small saplings along the edge of them now, and within a couple of years they'll already be there ready to replace that fence when it comes down, or just leave it and it'll naturally rot behind it. But by doing that, you're creating a really good habitat for birds, insects and other wildlife, like small mammals, hedgehogs and things like that, which otherwise just don't really have many places to go anymore.
So there are a few urban myths and horror stories about people planting in hedges that climb up to 12 foot high and take over the skyline. Is there anything that we should avoid, and what would you recommend that we put in that stays and grows in a relatively straightforward way, in a measured way?
The Leylandii are the big problems that were planted back in the 70s and 80s that just went sky high, way more than above house height, right up as far as the eye could see. I would be very cautious about those. I mean, a lot of people plant them because they grow very quickly and screen off their neighbours or anything else that you don't want to be looking into your garden. But they do need to be maintained. And once they get above a certain height, it's very difficult to keep that, to keep on top of it. So they get out of control very quickly. Personally, the hedges that I would recommend that people put into their garden, you might want to be looking at things like beech and hornbeam, which are nice during the summer, but also during that winter months, they still have those golden leaves that just stay on the branches until the new buds come through and push them off. So they look good all year round. You've got other evergreens like the yew and the privet hedge, and even laurel and box, which create a good screening through the whole year being evergreen. But each one of them has their own advantages. Yew looks very nice, but it is a quite a slow growing plant, whereas you can get a similar effect with things like privet, which is very simple to maintain. The laurel, which a lot of people are planting out at the moment, lovely big green glossy leaves, very easy to maintain, but that again can get out of control if you let it get too tall. Another popular one is box, which can take a little bit longer to grow, but it can be trimmed to be very, very sharp and nice sharp edges. It kept quite low, and if you really want to have a go, you can try your hand at the topiary and carving whatever you want out of your own little hedgerow to make your own little statement. And again, you can go for a normal, a more natural mixed hedgerow, things like hazel and hawthorn and even maybe holly in there as well, which creates such a wide habitat for things, has the berries there as well and the nuts, and just feeds a lot of wildlife in your garden. Possibly something that a garden fence won't be able to provide is security, because you can cross over a fence very quickly, whereas you could grow something like the pyracantha, which is also known as the firethorn. There's very sharp spines on that, covered in berries in the autumn and looks stunning throughout the year. And or a very nice purple coloured berberis, which again looks really nice, but it's covered in little spines, and very few people would want to go over through or over one of those. So yeah, there's a lot more advantages in my opinion to a natural hedgerow.
You mentioned that there's a lot of wildlife that can benefit from a hedge. Can you be more specific and tell us who might be living in there?
The obvious one is the bird life. Birds absolutely love nesting in the hedgerows. It's protection from predators. It's also protection from the wind and the elements and the rain, prying eyes and other cats as well, potentially, depending on what the hedge is. You've got quite a wide range of garden birds will nest in your hedge, like the sparrows and the blue tits and the great tits. But also people might like to see, look out and see the things like the robins in there and the dunnocks and the blackbirds, which have the benefit of eating all the pests and the bugs and the insects that, as a gardener, you don't always want to be on your plants, all the caterpillars that are eating away at your vegetables. That with the hedges as well, you've also got the berries that the birds would like to eat, especially if you're growing things like the pyracantha or the hawthorn, which are great during the winter, with providing winter food, which birds do find difficult in the winter to find. Apart from the birds, you've also got the insect life, which I know most gardeners won't want to see a lot of insects in their garden, but again, they are feeding those birds, and the more insects that you have in your garden, the more birds you're going to attract in there. And what people often overlook is the fact that many of these insects prey on other insects, like your aphids and your green flies and things that a gardener doesn't want. So they do keep the level down and help in a garden to keep it pest-free. Plus, they also dispose of all the dead material, all the plant leaves and things that are rotting down, that the insects will come along and start helping with that breakdown process. Recently, there's been quite a large report about the decline in moths and the number of moth species that have declined by 90 to 99% in some cases. A lot of people do think that moths are the boring sister to the butterfly, which is completely untrue. I think a lot of moths, if people actually realise what were moths and what were butterflies, they'd probably get a lot of them confused. There's some really very colourful, very attractive moths out there. I mean, in the UK, we can still get a hummingbird hawk moth, which appears to many people just to look like a hummingbird. It hovers on plants, taking the nectar and moving on from one plant to another, and it's quite large. And if you see it, it's an amazing sight to see in a garden. You've also got things like the six-spotted burnet moth and the garden tigers and the magpie moths, and all of these are amazing sights to see in a garden. When you see them, you don't often come across a moth in it during daylight hours, but when you do, it's quite different to what you're expecting. The advantage of having the hedgerows in the garden, I think it's one thing that gardeners can do for moths is grow these hedges, because it gives these moths the shelter and the protection that they need. And it's the habitat destruction with the loss of all the hedges over the last 20, 30 years, which accounts for a lot of the declines in moth numbers. And I think by replanting, and rather than just going for a straightforward fence panel, you can do your little bit in your garden to give a habitat for these insects that are really struggling. And even if hedges aren't your thing or don't suit your garden, you can still replicate them with shrubs in your garden, which have a similar effect as a hedgerow. You could put in things like hypericum, weigelas, potentillas, or just even the hardy fuchsias will attract not only the insects and the butterflies and the bees, but they also look really good from a gardener's perspective as well. You still can be helping with a hedgerow to provide somewhere like a home for hedgehogs, little wooden field mice, which aren't interested in going to your house, do stay in your garden, and they are quite happy to be out in those hedgerows. And again, they're just another thing that's suffering with a lack of places to live. So putting a hedge into your garden, I think, is one of the most beneficial things you can do as a gardener for any sort of wildlife. And also it looks great in your garden as well.
Thank you very much, Jodie.
Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, is back with another poem.
This is called In the Big Tent. At the powwow, in the big tent, deep in deepest Downing Street, all the big chiefs gather gaily for the end of year big meet. Toffee noses, jaunty jaunty, big society on course, get the people's work for nothing, steely hard times, no remorse. Give out honours like confetti, cheer the nation, rule, divide, Mega Sports Day celebrated, media circus well on side. Sporty, sporty Boris Blue Bike, exciting all the blue rinse squaws, making Cameron bit nervous. Boris indicate, up yours. Chiefy Clegg, he grumpy, grumpy, cause the Lord's tent still intact. You keep banner, rumpty tumpty, it be bigger threat, in fact. Gather, gather, farmers, sailors, say to leave the EU club, find the clitoris of the party. Nigel, he know where to rub. Not afraid of Millie Beanie, with his big brave bully balls, new one nation in between he, won't be long before it falls. Battle on into the new year, beat the drum for more the same, bash the plebs and lower orders, always are the best to blame. We no tax the smarty high class in the mansions of the land, look after those who know the system, sacred law, supply, demand. Glory, glory, hallelujah, second term is bright in sight. Slay the Libby Demi faction, then march further to the right.
That's all from Backchat this week. Studio engineer was Adrian Petrowski, the producer, Anthea Page. So it's goodbye from me, Kirsty Ball.
And me, Kay Sangandaffy.
And me, Marie Langan.
Until next week, goodbye.